before you answer, I'll pass to the next one. We'll have two questions. Okay. I think we're used to the time.
It's just a colleague of yours recently said that the UK was overtaxed, overregulated, and government borrows and spends too much. I just wondered what your comment was on that.
Well, that ain't in a way. I'm a firm believer in parliamentary democracy. And it has always been a great dilemma as how do democratic politicians retain power and do responsible things? Because, you know, there always has been a populist end of politics which realises that every increase in expenditure buys you a vote with some lobby and every reduction in taxation buys you a vote with another. And if you do it all by referendum, as they do in California, you're in a permanent state of complete bankruptcy because they all vote for the tax cuts and they all vote for the public expenditure increases. Eventually you go bust. We got near to that. To be fair, across Western Europe, it was not just the politicians. It was true of half the business world as well. And so the banking and financial world. And we have these South Sea bubble phases, which worry me because they're coming around with more frequency than they have most opportunities. After the dot-com bubble, which was about blatant nonsense and cost a lot of people a lot of money, within a few months we had this mad, you know, only 5 years later we had a credit bubble. And the banks lost all common sense. The securitization of debt was utterly crazy. The regulators were completely, utterly useless, brave and learned men with knighthoods. They had lots, armies of people regulating the wrong things in the financial services industry. The politicians were blind to it and joined with everybody else in thinking this is free money. And you just borrow it, and the public loved it. Vince and I used to be a couple of dreadful old moaners in the House of Commons, getting up and complaining about the government spending plans. And our party had to give up criticising them because it was costing us votes. We think we draw bail now over the fact we agreed we would adopt the Labour Party's spending and taxation plans after 2005 because we'd been so battered in the 2005 election for daring to suggest that not all of this was affordable. So that even the public participate to a certain extent. So in addition to tackling the thing now, I think politicians across the West can see the consequences of this kind of madness. And of course we have got things like what we're doing on bank regulation, where we're going in step with others, but we're being tougher than the Europeans actually. Basel III we're going to comply with, then you know, obviously going to be compatible. We're going to be banking, we're having our own banking regulation and they're having theirs, and ours, if anything, be tougher. We've got Vickers and so on we're legislating for. And I hope the experience, you know, lasts. But on recent fall, if you're not careful, you know, within 10 years, you'll have a generation of bankers, a generation of chief executives, and a generation of regulators and politicians will have forgotten all that. And there'll be another great craze will sweep through. I hope next time they're quicker at picking up. The trouble is this time it became really disastrous before the tide turned. But I attended whole conferences in about 2006, 2007, and the securitization of debt was regarded as an amazing invention. You didn't have to worry about the risk anymore. All you had to do was set up a special investment vehicle and you sold your debt to the special investment vehicle. And then there was no risk on your balance sheet. And you could lend some more. So somebody wanted a mortgage, he told you what his income was, he probably hadn't got a job at all, and you valued his property, you gave him 130%, and he didn't mind because he had got any money and he wasn't going to be able to pay this, but he got to sell it in 6 months because by that time the capital value had gone up and he'd make some money, and the mortgage broker got his commission. So when you say politicians are blind, I can only say, look back 6 years, and we were all blind. This madness was regarded as the norm. So I hope the politicians, but also others, it dawns upon them that they do have a certain elementary rules of prudence. The words I always dread to hear when anybody's discussing economic policy is, but this time it's different. And when people started saying the new economics, this time it's different. All this risk assessment stuff was boring old bank manager rubbish that you didn't need to bother with anymore. came out of it, everything scale, everything was going wrong, that all this was going to end in total disaster again. And the politicians are better, and the public are better, remember. The next time some joker gets up saying it can all be solved by tax cuts, or it can all be solved by restoring all the cuts in welfare, or let's just borrow some more money, or the various remedies that are on the whole being peddled around Western Europe at the moment.
Next question. Podic here at the front.
Will happen when the banks reopen in Cyprus?
Or just use a mic, that's good. Thanks.
What will happen when the banks reopen in Cyprus?
Well, I hope that things have been sorted out before the banks reopen in Cyprus. I was in Brussels on Monday. It's probably, you know, this must be Edinburgh, right? Look outside, it looks cold. But I've got other things on Brussels, and this Cypriot thing had obviously just broken, and it's just incredible. An extraordinary thing to have done. And what I was being assured there by the commissioner I was talking with was he thought it was the Cypriot government had insisted on doing it this way. The depositors have got to take a hit, the equity holders and the bond holders should take a hit, but that's not happening anywhere because of the knock-on effect of allowing, that's why we can't allow, that's why we keep bailing these things out, because the don't rescue the bondholders. The bondholders turn out to be banks that then go belly up themselves, and you got yourself a real Lehman Brothers collapse type consequence on your way again. But what we have across the entire of Europe, I thought, was for depositors in banks and financial institutions a guarantee, 100,000 euros, it's 80,000 we moved it to here after the BlackRock scare, and it's just taken for granted that you don't allow ordinary depositors at that kind of level to lose their money. And what would happen here is, above that, if your bank goes bust, you do. The answer, if you've, everybody here has got hundreds of thousands of pounds they wish to put in savings accounts, which in present circumstances I wouldn't recommend, I suggest you went to a financial advisor, but if you have some reason for keeping it tucked away in foreign bank accounts, don't put it all in one account, because you'll only be guaranteed up to 100,000. And the Cypriot government was so worried that all this hot money from Russia, Greece, and everywhere else would flow out of their banking system, that they decided that they wanted to spread the burden. They've got to raise all this money to reassure the Germans and the IMF they were making a contribution to being bailed out. So rather than upset these nice Russians, they had this hit of their ordinary savers. What kind of parliament was ever going to pass that? I have no idea. I wouldn't have voted for it. And it's crazy. And I hope they're firmly back with the deposit, the guarantee system of the European norm when they reopen. Some of the big money probably, it should be lost. I don't know if they impose on them. They'll have to make up what they don't get from the small depositors. They're still not apparently intended to clear out the big deposits. And it was just somebody somewhere, and the theory was it was the Cypriot government. I suppose they've attracted so much money into their banks from various places, not just Russia, that they're worried about it all going away. But there's no basis for the Cypriot economy. I mean, I hate, of course, I'm sure they're all frightfully reputable people with these large amounts of money in the Cypriot banks. There must be some very good reason for having £500,000 in a Cypriot bank of that kind. But I think the reason Germans and everybody else got rather sensitive about no hit at all was they couldn't quite see why they should take a hit and a bailout in order to save all these unknown people who didn't seem to want to pay tax or anybody to know quite where the money came from in various jurisdictions around the world. But to hit the small savings, absolute madness. Absolute madness. And I hope they've firmly reversed it on the open.
Gentleman here, and Bruce over there. We'll take both questions.
All right, question. Yeah. Excuse me. Hello?
Yeah, on you.
Will you welcome or be worried if inflation is allowed to persist?
Will I welcome, sorry?
Will you welcome or will you be worried if inflation is allowed to persistently tick up?
Well, no, I would. If inflation started to tick up, I would be worried. I mean, We are having to go in for extraordinary measures of monetary policy. I have been persuaded of that. If central bank governors can be persuaded of that, I can be persuaded of that. They all have now. Even the Bank of Japan is changing. Fed has for some time. We have for some time. The sticklers, the European Central Bank, but even they, have made it quite clear they will step in to pretend collapse, which means buying bonds if necessary. So, and it, if you look at the surplus, it's just absolutely essential. But in normal times, of course, I would say QE and all this kind of thing is dreadful. And buying your own government's bonds used to be a complete no-no, a sort of joke way of proceeding. But the alternative was complete collapse. And you've got to be ready to act once inflation starts ticking up at any rate. But the reason I think it has worked, actually, I think Lord knows where we'd be if the central banks had not gone in for unorthodox monetary policy, is because there are no other inflationary pressures. Now, what would normally take us back to hyperinflation is not going to take us back to hyperinflation at the present state of depressed demand, low confidence, people hoarding money, consumers and businesses paying off debt, governments paying off debt. So it's safe, but when we redo the mandate for the Bank of England, it was quite clear today, he's not abandoning the inflation target. And I'm sure the new governor, if you show signs of inflation getting out of control, doing more than just tick up a bit, he will have to act. Because maybe my generation, but I can remember all those people who used to talk 20, 30 years ago when inflation was our problem. It was terribly tempting to have a little bit of inflation. And when the anti-inflation policies were getting unpopular and were squeezing people a bit, I've seen chancellors try, well, just a little bit of inflation is all right. And a little bit of inflation used to be just the precursor of a very, very nasty reversion to hyperinflation again. But no, right now, inflation is not the problem that the Americans, the Japanese, the Europeans, and ourselves are staring in the face, and they're not likely to for a bit. But they still keep inflation targets. And Bernanke in the States has got a cut-off above, and he reserves the right to start tightening once inflation gets above 3, I think it's in that. But actually what we're doing is, as it would be disastrous to move promptly, it hovers above 2% for a bit. We just don't aim at 2%, but not so quickly, and you have regard to other things.
Okay, thank you very much, Bruce.
And it requires a strict fiscal discipline. If a government has sort of lost control of its public finances, I think all the countries I'm talking about, the central bank governments would want to start tightening monetary policy very rapidly.
Can I change the subject towards taxation?
The individual up here who's been the man who's spent the money, we've got a very professional audience, many of whom highest ethical standards of collecting the tax or organising that tax collection. The moral compass debate around avoidance, evasion seems to move at the moment, and some politicians have rather plagued the press in terms of making comments about the accountancy profession. How do you see the accountancy profession role going forward in the great tax morality debate?
Well, we've been trying to catch up on avoidance and evasion for the last 2 or 3 years. George has announced further steps. He's aiming to get $4.5 billion out of further anti-avoidance measures. And the first thing is to, on the plainly illegal, is to be better at cracking down on it. That has been lax, but we have been putting more resources into the revenue doing that. And that's obviously necessary. And on ordinary avoidance of taxes, most accountants do actually have a perfectly legitimate interest in minimising the amount of tax they pay beyond that which they're actually legally obliged to pay. It's no good expecting people to treat tax paying as kind of charity. You've got to close the more comic loopholes. And the things which are obviously designed not for any sort of real purpose, except it's designed for the purpose of catching some provision in the Finance Act. Now, that's usually a cat and mouse game between accountants and the revenue. Finance bill after finance bill as they try to close whatever has emerged in recent times. The general avoidance measure, I think, is extremely interesting. See what will happen. If a device is entered into, we're plainly, the motive for it is solely to avoid a tax liability that would otherwise be incurred for some activity that is liable to tax, taking more sweeping powers to be able to step in and close it. And the accountancy profession know perfectly well what is legitimate advice on minimising tax and taking advantage of allowances to which the client is entitled, and sometimes getting the client to construct his or her business in a way takes advantage of allowances. And on the one hand, going into really ingenious but very dodgy schemes which purport to be supporting the British film industry have got charitable status but are doing nothing at all but enabling someone to put their income or earnings well beyond tax. And we've got very lax at it, and everybody's now having a go at it. I don't see the reason. There's no reason not having a taut and efficient scheme. You also need a tax system which has taxes which are easy to collect. I think all chances should keep an eye on which taxes are good little earners, because they're easy to collect and more difficult to avoid.
Okay. This gentleman here.
What are your views on Scotland's ability to be financially independent?
I see absolutely no purpose in Scotland to do that. I think, I mean, on the independence generally, including financial independence, I just think in Scotland, England, and the rest of the United Kingdom, we'd just all be losers. I think in the modern world, to start deciding to, I mean, it's not linked to my views on the European Union, partly, suddenly decide to diminish the scale of your activities and to increase the scale of your exposure, as it were, to the modern world in today's globalised economy, I think is slightly reckless. And I think we get, all of us get great strengths, the English as much as the Scots, from the size of the British economy, the integration of the British economy, the clout it gives us in international gatherings, and therefore the ability to take risk and have a variety of sources of income and so on. I mean, Cyprus, to me, follows Iceland and Ireland as an example of the risk that we run if your political class lose control of things. If you're a small country with vast financial obligations piling up within your jurisdiction, which you're not able to control, and without, I'm sure the Royal Bank of Scotland is well on the way to recovery and going to return to the market soon, Tom, but it still has one or two problems. Now, one of the things we're all conscious of, British, is the liabilities of the Royal Bank of Scotland greatly exceed the GDP of the United Kingdom. Fortunately, it hasn't failed, because as people are complaining, it's too damn big to fail. If it failed, we'd all be in a dreadful Irish-type mess. Now, Scotland, just deciding for some peculiar reason to become financially distinct and independent from the rest of the United Kingdom, would have the Royal Bank of Scotland, I assume, on its books, and would be facing it. Now, I just don't think it's very wise. And nor do I see what earthly advantage is supposed to be. Well, one of the things I'm doing at the moment is trying to get the European level free trade agreements going in the world. Now, I think one of the obvious, in my view, is I think an obvious win-win situation for Western economies is to have, if we possibly get it, a European Union, United States trade agreement. A European Union, Japan trade agreement. Nothing like a recession for concentrating the mind. The Americans are up to it for it, which they never used to be. The Japanese are up for it. It's going to be very difficult to negotiate. But we are actually a negotiating mandate setting out on that path. Now, I don't think the United Kingdom would be wise to say, no, we're not joining the European Union US trade agreement, we're going to have a British US trade agreement. They're big boys on the other side of the table when you sit down in Washington. They need the clout of the biggest market in the world. And in the United Kingdom, the English and the Scots and the Welsh and the Ulstermen are actually in the one of the three most powerful countries, one of the second biggest economy in the European Union. So I can sit down with Americans, you can sit down with Japanese, we matter. And you can sit down with European Commissions. And we matter. Now, of course, the small countries in Europe all matter. And small countries matter in the WTO and all the rest of it. But what on earth is the point when our economies are so integrated in, it's absolutely no doubt, moving yourself to the margins in discussing all these things? And I'm sorry to go back to the same, because I've got a while now, countries are very sad they're in such a mess. You know, I can't help remembering when Ireland and Iceland were held up as a model to which the Scots were supposed to be aspiring. Well, you can't have it both ways. They seem to be in some trouble. And there's always, I gather you're having a debate in Scotland now. Apparently it doesn't matter because we've got so much oil that you're kind of Norway. So you don't have to bother with modern economic problems because there's so much oil revenue that we're all right. Well, I think oil revenue is very useful, fine. British oil interests as well, but it's mainly Scottish. I do a lot of stuff trying to help the oil industry, and I'm trying to get the Brazilian market, one of the jobs I have at the moment, going with people mainly from Aberdeen into Brazil. But oil revenues are very valuable, any luck, keep going for some years, but you haven't got oil revenues like Abu Dhabi, and they are going to diminish. And the trouble with oil revenues, and trouble with energy markets is they're absolutely unpredictable. Scottish oil generates a lot of revenue when you've got the tax system right, which the UK has now, and when oil commodity prices, energy price movements actually make extracting more out of North Sea beneficial. Now, of course, it's all interest. As long as we stayed in the United Kingdom, and I was keen on extracting every last drop that's profitable out of the North Sea, as every Scot is, and it's all part of the. This is how you ought to be keen on not only Edinburgh Financial Services, but getting the City of London back to an honest and profitable state, because we generate a lot of money that way as well. But I wouldn't bet the ranch on it. And if the entire future of a nation state depends on the oil markets, enabling what's left of North Sea oil to generate really massive revenues the next 40 years, well, you know, good luck. I'm not sure. As far as I gather, what they do here is put out highly optimistic forecasts of the revenue. So I advise they look at the OBR's forecast today, when they are independent and they keep producing forecasts we don't like all that much, but they can't just wave it away and say, no, I have an insight that energy markets are in favour of some vast sets of income flowing in for the next 40 years. I believe it when I see it. So I just think the freestanding Scottish economy, I don't see the advantage. What is the point? The risks are quite considerable.
Thank you, Ken.
And actually, for, I think we might regret it because it wouldn't do us any good either. It would be damaging, cost us some growth as well, I've no doubt.
Okay, a couple more questions. Yes, there's a gentleman here and a lady here at the front. Two ladies first there.
I was just going to ask, there's a lot of Scottish companies that are kind of at the leading edge in terms of innovation and things like life sciences and energy and renewables. So what do you see as the key steps that the government are taking to support R&D investment?
Well, there have been some new R&D measures announced today. I can't claim that I've got my folder down there. I'm not quite, I can give you a completely, that I think in the industrial strategy, life sciences is quite an important part of that. And I think we've announced some more money going to life sciences today, that is, I mean, supporting R&D generally, supporting cutting edge industry in this country, startups, high tech, all that, it's a no brainer. I mean, we just have to do that for the benefit of future generations. We have moved a million miles away from the economic debates of 30, 40 years ago, where the entire efforts of the British nation were put into preserving rust bucket businesses that were plainly dying, pouring our resources into keeping them going, which sadly was not possible. Fortunately, we didn't delay their end too long, and sadly, you can never quite make it as smooth as you would like it to be. But right now, life sciences is one of our strengths, very much one of our strengths. We have an excellent reputation in that field. It's one of the areas where we need a strategy of being alongside and making sure that there is proper investment in research and development. And I'm sure there have been announcements about life sciences today. And the whole life sciences healthcare market is one way, one of Britain's strengths. And again, one of my own sort of jobs is trying to get our healthcare exports generally into the big emerging markets where we still get left behind. So working with people in healthcare and life science industries to get into Brazil, India, China, because now they've become wealthy, now they're developed, they're going to pour billions and billions of dollars in bringing their healthcare systems up to par to keep their inhabitants satisfied they're getting benefits out of the nation's new wealth. And we're one of the strongest countries in the world in all those fields, and we should be in those markets. So it's one of the things we're doing. But that's got to be a priority. It's got to be a priority. And not only do we have to go to the immediate crisis, we have to look at the health economy. Obviously, the economy we've got to look at is the economy we want in 20 years' time. Not just the economy we had when we went into the recession, because some of that won't come out. It's what kind of economy is going to now keep us head to head with all these new Asian competitors.
You mentioned that the corporation tax is going down to 20%, and that's most competitive in the G20. Do you see a reversal of incorporations setting up their head office in Ireland? Do you see more of the big multinationals suddenly, like Starbucks declaring their profits in Britain?
Well, that's one of the main intentions, yes. We do need inward investment. And one of the advantages we have, I guess, back to these trade agreements, we have become one of the most open free trading countries in the world. That all the protectionism, which is the norm in many parts of the world, has practically vanished for the time being in the United Kingdom, and quite right too, as we've got used to deriving the benefits of having international partners, international investment. We've just got to make this place attractive, and having low competitive rates of corporate taxation is one way of doing that. And of course, it does no harm to establish business already here, British owned or overseas owned. I mean, we are actually the cost that corporate taxes at least are imposing on British industries when we're trying to get a bit of an export led recovery going is helped by getting the burden of corporate taxation down. And going back to the irresponsibility of politicians, the reason that corporate business taxes often get loaded to the gunwales by elected governments is there are more votes in cutting taxes for individuals. Nobody minds if you tax business, because business collectively doesn't have a vote, and they don't see that customers pay it, and they don't see that it affects its competitors, so that's the easy place to hit for money. We reverse that, we have to. But it should be beneficial. One of the main aims is to seek to attract more inward investment. That is going to be necessary.
Thank you very much, Ken.
Is that it? Right, okay. Thank you very much.
Apologies for the abrupt end, but ladies and gentlemen, there is an evening ahead of other activities, but this has been a special event for ICAS tonight. It's not very often that we get a former Chancellor on Budget Day. We are grateful for joining us this evening. We are grateful that you share a vision for prudence. You could have been an honorary member of this institute who espouses great prudence. We also admire you that you did not have any vested interest at all or personal interest in the 1p reduction and a pint of beer today. But I'm sure, Ken, you will avail yourself of such a benefit. Ladies and gentlemen, it's been great to have so many of you here. For those of you for whom this is a first time at an ICAS event, let it not be the last. We will have many more, and we look forward to seeing you again. And ladies and gentlemen, if you would like to join with me in thanking Ken Clark for joining us this evening.